Well, looking out at all these wonderful faces, I'm having visions of All Saints Day for some reason. All these beautiful, venerable faces from near and far, geographically, time-wise, life-wise, remarkable. And it's a fitting tribute to the remarkable practice of Urban Session that we've been having this week under the steady hand of our tillerman, Mouchon. And I really do want to underline remarkable. In the sense of taking us to waters, uncharted territories that get us to expand our idea of ourselves, that get us, I took us to edges of the unknown, if you will, and got us to practice how it is to be together and learn together. There's something about Urban Session. I mean, it happened this year, last year. There's an amazing thing that happens, bringing in talent, creativity, and infusing the Dharma, I think, with a whole new aliveness. That I felt very privileged to be part of. And for some reason this week, you know, with the kinds of outings and the creativity, I had this sense or this idea of how what Google and the Village Zendo have in common. Now, I know for some of you, Google's not your favorite friend these days. You have questions about its politics, very rightly. But nonetheless, we have to acknowledge that Google's probably the most successful company that has ever existed in mankind. Successful enterprise, shall we say. And that it has created tools that we have come to rely on. And Thomas Friedman from the New York Times recently, I think as a result of an interview with somebody in Google, learned that of course, you know, they have the best talent of the world applying, wants to work there. So they get to choose. So how do they choose? Apparently they have 5 criteria. And I thought, well, these 5 criteria have an uncanny resemblance to the attributes required of any shuso at the Village Zendo. So here they are. Number one, they say, is learning ability. And that they define not in terms of IQ scores or high GPA, but the ability to process on the fly. Number 2, leadership. We're not traditional. They're not so much interested in traditional leadership, so much as what they call emergent leadership, the ability to step in and lead. And then, just as importantly, step back and no longer lead. Third, humility. Google says they don't hire experts. They want people who can learn, who are interested in learning and relearning. For a big enough ego to believe in your own ideas and stand for them, stand behind them, and then a small enough ego to acknowledge when someone's idea is better. Five, not being afraid of failure. And I thought our Musho passed those criteria with flying colors. He's consummately organized, impeccable planner, and yet, on day one, what was he faced with? The oatmeal wasn't ready. And so his impeccable timing and all of that, he had to handle. He was completely unfazed, took it in his stride, and then came up, of course, with this theme of the three treasures expressed through art, storytelling, music, and structured activities and events that allowed all of us to engage, participate, and again, you see, push the envelope in terms of what we knew or could do. And to me, what was the most impressive, you see, was this beautiful flexibility in being open to collaboration. Hanging out there at the edge of the unknown. Here's our task. How do we do it? Inviting the entire team to contribute, to problem solve, so that we were fully, fully engaged and people's ideas listened to, things tried, things dropped. And it was really an extraordinary experience in just that, in trusting that we could work together and accomplish something, even though the whole thing could have gone up in smoke. And so Google, it seems to have caught on to the fact that the future belongs to those who can do that, can hang out in the unknown, play with it, push it, tease it. So there's something, I think, that for me Musho brings a very 21st century quality to his being that kind of puts Zen into the 21st century and so that it is completely at home in this world we're living in that is moving so fast that it seems as soon as we touch something, it dissolves into air. And so how do we stay centered? And that's, of course, what our practice is all about. And yet what I love about him is, you know, there's a saying in Japanese that says, what smells like miso is not miso. It comes directly from the, I think, from the Diamond Sutra. What smells like miso is not real miso. And, you know, so we have the stink of Zen. If we have the stink of Zen, we're not, that's not Zen. Musho doesn't have the stink of Zen, therefore, he is Zen. His song Rohatsu and Bodhidharma could be show tunes on Broadway. And I'm hoping that we'll move towards a musical. And I think his art is also saying something that is quite profound, which is that all representation is fantasy. All representation is fiction. All representation is fabulous, made up, make-believe. And there's that interesting combination of someone who's able to take their responsibilities completely seriously and yet not take themselves so seriously. And I really admire that. So, thank you, Shuso. Speaking of representations, how we want to be seen. The teacher Panchan, when he was approaching death, said to his monks, "Is there anyone among you who can draw my likeness?" Many of the monks made drawings for Panchan, but none were to his liking. A monk stepped forward and said, "I can draw it." Panchan said, "Why don't you show it to me?" The monk then turned and did a somersault and went out. Panchan said, "Someday that fellow will teach others in a crazy manner." Having said these words, he passed away, and his pagoda was named Truth's Limit. Truth's Limit. And I thought, my God, how long it's been since I've ever done a somersault. Do you remember? As kids, we would do them all the time. It's like kids kind of were in touch with what's real. And somehow we were educated to stand up straight, keep your feet firmly on the ground, and don't fall. So, this is one of our issues, isn't it, that we have fixed ideas of ourselves that don't reflect this constantly dynamic, changing reality. And that we can even use the Dharma, can't we, to find that fixed, safe, secure place to nest in. Which the Buddha already, even before Buddhism was kind of off the ground, was aware would happen. So he comes upon the monks who are arguing about which dharma is the truest, which is the right way to do things, the wrong way. And he tells them the parable of the raft. Where there's a traveler who's stuck. Can't move forward, can't move back. But in front of them is this expanse of water. And at the other side, they see a place. If they can get there, then they'll be okay. There's no bridge, there's no ferry. So they look around and find things that they can fashion a raft from, a log, vine, pieces of twig. In using their arms and legs, they navigate across. So then the Buddha says to his monks, "So what do you think, monks? This traveler, should he continue carrying the raft that has brought him safely to shore, or should he put it down in gratitude and carry on?" The monks say, "Well, put it down." And the Buddha said, "And so likewise, my teachings, which are like this raft, to be put down." So, you know, he's talking to monks of the time are called home leavers, aren't they? They're travelers. They've made a commitment to not be attached. To not seek out comfort, but to forgo comfort in order to keep moving towards, well, what? Ultimately, I guess, that which relies on nothing except what is available in the moment, moment by moment. And that changes. That changes, except we so much want to create our nest and make ourselves comfortable and safe. And then sometimes, even without our knowing it, something shifts from under us and we find ourselves in a different place. Almost the raft is taken from us or falls away. Rebecca Solnit, in her book, A Field Guide to Getting Lost, she talks about these transitions in life whereby you cease to be who you were. She says sometimes an old photograph, an old friend, an old letter will remind you that you are not who you once were. For the person who dwelt among them, valued this, chose that, wrote thus, no longer exists. Without noticing, you have traversed a great distance. The strange has become familiar, and the familiar, if not strange, at least awkward or uncomfortable, an outgrown garment. And she continues, some people, she said, travel more than others. There are those who receive as birthright an adequate or at least unquestioned sense of self. And those who set out to reinvent themselves for survival or satisfaction and travel far. Some people inherit values and practices as a house they inhabit. Some of us have to burn down that house, find our own ground, build from scratch, even as a psychological metamorphosis. And so she says, we have to leave the door open for the unknown, the door into the dark. That's where the most important things come from and where you will go. That's where we're headed. And there are, as we know, many Zen stories that show us we have to be willing to get lost. Tokusan, all puffed up at the studies of the sutra, bested by the cake seller on the road. He has an awakening experience when his teacher blows out the candle and leaves him in total darkness. When a young disciple asks Obaku, remember the 8th century giant with the bump on his head from bowing, what is the way and how must it be followed? Obaku says, what sort of thing do you think the way is that you wish to follow it? And of course, this echoes the words of this philosopher, pre-Socratic, Menlo, who says, how will you go about finding the thing, the nature of which is totally unknown to you? So the student replies to Obaku, well, what instructions have the masters everywhere given for meditation, for practice and the study of the Dharma? Obaku said, words are used to attract the dull of wit and are not to be relied on. Are not to be relied on. Words are used to attract the dull of wit and are not to be relied on. But the student persisted. He said, if those teachings are meant for the dull-witted, I have yet to hear what Dharma has been taught for those of high capacity. Obaku replies, if you're really of high capacity, where could you find a teacher to follow? Seeing the key word is, of course, follow. The danger is that we, like the ducks who imprint, you see on the first thing they see when they're born, that we will model ourselves on the teacher. We want to look like she looks, walk like she walks, talk like she walks. We make the mistake of thinking we know what we're looking for. But luckily, we are usually waylaid, aren't we, by the unforeseen. Those bumps in the road that really are our true teachers. After 3 years of residency at Zen Mountain Monastery, I had decided to leave. Fork in the road was be a monk or do something else with your life. And there were other things I wanted to learn. I knew I had to leave to learn them. But it wasn't easy. There was a lot that was compelling about that life. Structured practice, living in community, interesting people, good people. Sitting, learning about the Dharma, working, living in the countryside. But something was tugging at me, and so I knew I had to leave. And as we know, every choice involves loss, giving up of a certain identity, a certain sense of belonging, sense of safety and security, being with people who care about you. But it felt like the right thing. And so I also looked forward to a fresh start. And it was August. So I was going to go back to the city, start a whole course of study, master's in social work. And I thought, you know what, why don't I just give myself a bit of a holiday before I, you know, head into the grind again. And I thought of Omega Institute up in Rhinebeck. You know, they have a lake, you can go swimming, they have these cool workshops, drumming, chanting, you know. You can get a work scholarship there and hang out for a month and play. So I applied and got this plum assignment, which I thought was very fitting, at the front desk greeting visitors. Now, the people at Omega, the most surprising thing was that they were all very at pains to show how spiritually evolved they were and how committed they were to their practice, their gurus. And it was all about love and light and peace. A lot of that. So, you know, I thought, all right, I can handle this. And I was discreet about where I was coming from, finding my bearings. On the fourth day, I was told summarily to report to house cleaning, where my duties would be cleaning out the guest rooms, the bathrooms, the showers, and folding laundry in the sunshine for hours. My crime? Apparently, my smile in greeting the visitors wasn't big enough. It was a kind of a harsh landing. Here I was coming down off the mountain. And in a way, I didn't realize it until this moment. It was like I was traveling this Google luxury bus that was going to take me into town. And suddenly the bus is stopped and I'm asked to get out and walk. And I was in touch with the sense of entitlement. The sense of, you know, slight superiority among the sort of the great, the wannabes that I was, the spiritual wannabes. And that I, because of my thousands of hours of sitting on a cushion, was somehow destined for, well, more than cleaning out toilets. And so that's when we find out what we're attached to, isn't it? Because it hurts when it's taken away. And yet, that's what our practice is, isn't it? Over and over, find out what it is that is giving me that sense of being able to get over or buy time or enjoy status, privilege, because ultimately where we're headed is, isn't it, is that it's all going to be taken away. And, I mean, those of you I know even this year have had things far more than your self-pride ripped away. Some of you have lost jobs, health, relationships. Some are finding their roof over their head in question. And so what we learn, though, from the parable of the raft, I think, is that it's in times of danger that we discover resources that are available that we didn't know, that we hadn't seen, and that only when what I rely on customarily is taken away. That our true wealth becomes more apparent. And ultimately, of course, our path is, isn't it, to realize and discover that which cannot be taken away. So we have great privilege to have Sangha, to have the teachings, to have the support of practice to help us see clearly into that. Let go, let go, let go, let go, let go. So let's enjoy a day, another day of practice together.